Authors Over 50, Writing in Life's Sweetest Third. Authors Over 50's weekly podcast celebrates writers and their journeys to publication. Writing after 50 is a whole story on its own, so let's skip to Life's Sweetest Third and talk with authors about their journey from pen to publish. Welcome, I'm Julia Daly, your host, and I invite you to listen to interviews with writers who've achieved their goal of publishing a book just later in life. We've seen award lists for under 30 or under 40, but I've yet to see lists for those who've achieved a significant milestone of their own, launching a new career and publishing their first book after the age of 50. We will hear about these authors' inspirations, struggles, strategies, and the smell of that first book. These writers' journeys inspire me because I'm one of them. My guest today loves stories, reading and writing them, hearing and telling them. He has written four books, all very different from each other. His first is about hiking trips with his best friend. His memoir is about his adoption as an infant and the discovery of his birth mother's identity when he was nearly 50. A third and weirdest book consists entirely of conversations between him and his beloved dog. And his newest is a novel based on the life of his grandfather, who was both a gifted preacher and a convicted felon. In his spare time, he and his wife host house concerts, walk the dogs, and dance in the kitchen. Welcome to Authors Over 50, Brooks Eason.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brooks, our opening question is always, so what took you so long to write your first book?
I've got a good excuse for that. I was a full-time, very busy lawyer raising three children and had no time. And, you know, also, I guess I had never really thought, you know, this is something I want to do, write a book. I've always enjoyed writing. One Christmas when I was in law school and I was really poor, I gave my parents two short stories for Christmas because I didn't have any money to buy anything for them. But I didn't really have, you know, hey, I want to be an author and I want to write books. But then I started going on hiking trips with my best friend. My first book is Travels with Bobby, about those trips. And I would come home and Bobby's the funniest person on earth. And we had all these goofy things happen to us and saw magnificent places. And I would come home and just for months after our trips, it was all I talked about. I would tell stories from my travels with Bobby. And so after a few years, I decided I really should write this. And so that's how I got started and really enjoyed it. And it's very satisfying, as you know, when people read your books and tell you they enjoyed them. I've now written four and I'm working on my fifth.
Well, Brooks, you and I have much in common, being Mississippians and even being born in the same maternity home and adopted. And adoption is certainly one of the hot button issues in the news today. Can you share a little bit about your search and writing your memoir?
Well, I can't share anything about my search because I didn't search. I was searched for. I had wonderful, wonderful adoptive parents in Tupelo. Never searched for my birth mother, never would have. But I got found as a result of litigation in Oklahoma and in New Orleans, where I was born, trying to identify the baby boy born to my biological mother, Julia Francis, in July of 1957. And the reason that I was being searched for is because Julie was from a very, very wealthy family. And they didn't know who I was, but her child was a potential heir to her grandfather's fortune. Her grandfather owned oil and gas wells all over the country. And he also owned the only facility in the Western Hemisphere that made fluoride for toothpaste. So I didn't hit it rich. I didn't get any money, but I got a great story. Julie died long before I was born. But I've gotten to know a number of people in her family because they're my family too, and they've been very gracious. And we now have two portraits of Julie hanging in our dining room.
Well, our stories are so interesting. You know, that old Napoleonic law that was on the books in Louisiana said that an adopted child can inherit from their natural parents. Well, you can't inherit from somebody you don't know. So that was the loophole I used to gain my original birth certificate and searched and found my birth mother. And it was a very good situation. Some are not. And you have to be careful going in, you know, to if you want to know your health records and you want to know your story, you just have to be aware that it might not be a good situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, particularly when you and I were born, it was considered such a matter of shame for a young woman to have a child out of wedlock that they kept it a secret. As I'm sure you know, in the Methodist Home Hospital where we were born, they actually gave the girls aliases so the other girls wouldn't know their names and couldn't find out anything about them. And so, you know, a lot of women now had babies 50, 60 years ago and never told a soul. My birth mother's little brother didn't know that she had had me until after she died.
Yes, and my birth mother had not told her children, so that was a revelation for them as well. So yes, there were many, many secrets back then, and hopefully we're doing a better job these days with the adoptions. I hope that's true.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote about in my memoir was about the difference between the way things were and the way things are, because my birth mother got pregnant during the fall of her freshman year at Washington University in St. Louis. And I found out she was my birth mother 1 week before my first grandchild was born, my daughter having gotten pregnant during the fall of her sophomore year at Ole Miss. And so one of the things I wrote about is how my daughter was able to keep her baby, even though my mother couldn't keep hers.
Yeah, that's certainly a very interesting twist to our stories there. Brooks, once you knew you wanted to write your first book, how did you proceed? Did you search for an agent? Did you decide to use a hybrid, a small press, or did you self-publish?
Well, I spent a little bit of time trying to find an agent, and I got responses that were encouraging, but no acceptances. And so I put it aside for a while, and then I picked it up, and then finally decided I've worked a lot on it. I need to finish this and get it published. So I did self-publish through Lulu Press, my first book, and then you know, I've had publishers for the most recent three.
Well, are you still writing? Do you have a writing routine? Are you a morning person or a night person?
I am still writing. I don't have much discipline. I'm 90% retired from the practice of law. I typically don't write in the morning. I typically read the news and drink coffee and goof off and walk the dogs. And then I will write some in the afternoon, occasionally at night, but usually in the afternoon. And the book that I'm working on now will be a biography of my father, Paul Eason, who was the finest man I've ever known. And I've written about him some in the past, but he was a Boy Scout leader in Troop 12 in Tupelo, Mississippi for more than 60 years. And he was totally committed to it and excelled at it, and is loved and respected by many, many of his former Boy Scouts. So I've been interviewing them. I've interviewed some that are almost 90 years old, and some that are far younger than that who were Boy Scouts when Daddy was still working with the troop in his 80s. He last camped with the troop in January of 2008, when he was 2 months after he turned 86.
Wow, that's quite a legacy.
Yes, it is.
What about the editing process? Can you tell us about what editing process you go through?
You know, I edit extensively and read and revise and read and revise. I went to a program in the summer of 2018 at the University of Iowa, a creative writing program, and it was a small group about storytelling techniques. It was a week-long program, and one of the people in the group said he loved to write, but he hated to revise. And I told him, I said, I don't feel that way at all. I really enjoy going back and rereading something and making it a little better, and going back and reading it again and making it a little better still. I've never used a professional editor, but I've had friends who've reviewed the manuscript and given me ideas and made my books better.
Well, why don't you set up the book that you've brought to read to us today and read a few paragraphs or a section so we can hear your tone and voice in the book.
Okay. So my newest book, the title is Redemption, The Two Lives of Harry Brooks. It's a novel because I didn't know all the facts and I had to fill in a lot of blanks, but it's a novel based on the life of my grandfather. Harry was my grandfather. He died 15 years before I was born. I never knew a lot about him. I knew that he was a revered Methodist preacher, that he was very good at it, that the churches that he pastored grew extensively while he was leading them. Capitol Street Methodist Church here in Jackson grew by 500 members his first year there. And in 1934, when he was the preacher at the First Methodist Church in Tupelo, FDR came to Tupelo to speak to the people there, and people in North Mississippi from all over came into town. There were 75,000 people in Tupelo, which was then a town of 7,500, to see the president. And Harry, my grandfather, was chosen to give the invocation. And nobody in the crowd of 75,000 knew about Harry's secret past life. I didn't either until nearly four years ago. I got a call from a man in Fresno, California, who told me that he had discovered through a DNA test that he was my first cousin. He's not related to me by blood. He's related to my adoptive family by blood. His biological father, he had learned from the DNA test, was my adoptive mother's older brother. Anyway, he having learned that he had this new family he'd never known about, he was adopted out of our family a year before I was adopted into it. He set out to find out all he could about his family that he never knew he had. And the first thing he discovered was that our grandfather, Harry, that his father, Harry's father, died 5 years before Harry was born, which struck him as unlikely and whetted his curiosity. And he dug in to find out all he could about Harry. One of the things he found was that Harry had lied about his age by 14 years before he came to the South and became a Methodist preacher. His bogus birth date is on his gravestone in Texas. I think I told you that we went to Fredericksburg in May, and we drove home through a little tiny washed up town called Carlton, which is southwest of Fort Worth. And we visited the cemetery and we saw Harry's gravestone that says he was born December 29th, 1875. He was actually born on New Year's Day in 1862. Why did he do that? Why did he make up this past history? And he claimed he was from Kentucky. He was really from Pennsylvania. Well, the reason, as my newfound cousin in California discovered, was that while he was serving as the elected school superintendent in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, outside Pittsburgh, Harry had embezzled tuition payments, left his wife and children for a woman named Bess Montgomery from Pittsburgh, who was described in the press as a woman of doubtful repute. When Harry discovered that the law was after him, he tried to make his escape by booking passage to Liverpool on a Cunard liner using an assumed name. And I've got all these unbelievable newspaper articles from 1905 and 1906, you know, describing all the details of this. But Harry had made, he made a number of mistakes, but one mistake that he made was that he told his mistress where he was going and what his assumed name was and the ship he was going to be on, but he didn't take her with him. And he also borrowed money from the sheriff and didn't pay it back, which is always a bad idea.
Those were two mistakes right there.
So the sheriff found his mistress and, according to the newspaper, engaged in a sweating process. It didn't describe the details of the process, but whatever the sheriff did, Bess Montgomery ratted Harry out, and Scotland Yard was waiting when his ship reached port and he was arrested, and the sheriff followed him across the ocean blue to England and had him extradited, brought him home. He was tried, convicted, sentenced to 2 years and 10 months in Western Penitentiary in Pittsburgh. His wife, not surprisingly, divorced him, excuse me. His family disowned him. And when he got out in late 1908, he went to Texas and started over and never told a soul. And I'm sure my mother never knew. My mother and her identical twin were Harry's youngest children. We thought he was 45 when they were born. He was actually 59. When Harry gave the invocation in front of a crowd of 75,000 people in Tupelo, not a single person at the in the crowd knew that Harry was an ex-con. It's something that could not possibly happen today.
That's just fascinating. Fascinating.
You can find out more about him if you've got a subscription to newspapers.com or ancestry.com or just on the internet. You can find out more about him in an hour than my grandmother, who slept in the same bed with him for more than 30 years, ever knew.
Wow.
So anyway, to the best of my knowledge and from everything I've read, Harry lived an upstanding life as a Methodist preacher from the time he got to Texas until he died in 1942. We thought he was 66 when he died. He was actually 80. The title of the book is Redemption, because I concluded that that he experienced redemption and turned his life around. I wrote, as I said, it's a novel because I had a lot of blanks to fill in, and all I have is the historical facts, and I don't know when or where he experienced redemption and turned his life around, but I wrote that it happened in prison because I think it is common that that a person has to fall all the way to the bottom before he'll turn things around. So I guess that's the basic story. I will read a few paragraphs from the very end of the book.
Okay.
This is from the very end of the epilogue. So in the end, even with all that will never be known, what can we learn from Harry Brooks? What does his life teach us? One lesson is how much the world has changed in the last century. Harry lived at a time when there were trains, but no internet. In his day, a man could escape from his troubles for the price of a westbound ticket. He could stay tucked inside a berth in a sleeping car for 24 hours, wake up 1,000 miles away and walk out of the train into a new land where no one knew a thing about him. He could make a new life for himself with little fear that his old one would come back to haunt him. That's what Harry did, and it worked for nearly 30 years. Harry turned 75 on New Year's Day, 1937. He no doubt believed he'd left his past behind for good, but then came the last Thursday in April, the day Tris knocked on the parsonage door. So this is a story that I knew before I learned the full story from my cousin. But my mother told me that when she was a teenager in Tupelo, that this middle-aged woman came and knocked on the door looking for her daddy. And she told me that when that happened, nobody in the family, not Harry's wife, my grandmother, his second wife, or his five children from his second marriage, knew that Harry had even been married before, much less that he had a child. It turned out that he had five children by his first wife.
Wow. So interesting. Very interesting. I love stories like that. The truth is often stranger than fiction, they say.
It's remarkable. So anyway, I'll continue. Compare then to now, when anyone with a laptop could learn more in an afternoon about Harry's past than Ethel, that's my grandmother, learned while sleeping in the same bed with him for more than three decades. Harry's life also serves as a stark reminder that there's no one among us who is either all good or all bad. We are all made up of both. In the first half of his life, Harry stole from his employer, betrayed his wife, abandoned his family, and tried to escape to another continent. But before he did any of that, he was a respected minister and educator, a good family man, and a community leader. Then in the second half, though he brought thousands of people to God and lived an upstanding and righteous life, he did not live a perfect one. He lied about his age and his past and concealed his prior sins. I believe on balance that Harry was a very good man, but he serves as proof positive that the words of Ecclesiastes are true. There is not a just man on earth who doeth good and sinneth not. Finally, the most important lesson to be learned from Harry's life, at least for me, is one of perseverance and redemption. How easy it would have been for Harry to wallow in guilt and self-pity after he found himself alone in a prison cell. How easy it would have been to give up on the future after he lost his wife, his family, his job, and his freedom. How easy it would have been to waste away his days serving neither God nor man. But Harry did not take the easy path. He came to the South, where he made a new life, raised a new family, and spent the rest of his days preaching the word of God. He devoted his life to saving souls, just as his own soul had been saved. He was a gifted preacher and received the grace of another gift, a second chance in a second life. He made the most of it, and his labors bore fruit as his churches went forward. Harry's fall from grace made him the man that he was. He understood sin. He understood loss and hopelessness, but he also understood forgiveness and redemption. All he achieved in the second half of his life was the result of how far he fell in the first. He lost everything and fell as far as a man could fall. He was lost, but then through God's grace, he was found.
Fascinating, fascinating.
It really is a remarkable story. When my cousin in California told me about it, I said, hey, look, you discovered this story, but if you don't write it, I'm going to.
Yeah.
And he said, have at it. So I did.
Well, Brooks, what publicity have you found that works or doesn't work to promote your books?
You know, I've done a lot of signings, and there have been pieces in periodicals that I think have worked. I've done podcasts like this, which hopefully work. It's sort of hard to find out. You know, the very best publicity is word of mouth. I was at a festival on Saturday. You probably remember it from when you were here, Day in the Country at the Chapel of the Cross. And so I was out there with my tent and my books and my banner selling books. And a woman came up and said, I've read your book. It's terrific. And I said, I don't want to say, would you just stand here and tell all the people who passed by that? Because there's no better, you know, there's no better publicity than word of mouth and people hearing from someone they trust that this is a good book and worth your time to read is the best publicity there is. Because, you know, I can tell people all of the time that, hey, you should read my book, but But I've got an ulterior motive in that, and people who just read the book don't. I think that works better than anything else.
Does your family support your career as a writer? Sometimes when we're writing memoir, we touch on a few nerves in our families.
Sure. Yes, they have supported it. Carrie, my wife, definitely. In my memoir, I wrote about my daughter becoming pregnant when she was in college, and she's a remarkable woman who started a school here in Risland. And I knew that she'd be fine with it, but her daughter, my first grandchild, who was also featured in the book, I wanted to make sure she was comfortable having a little bit of spotlight on her and having her story of being born out of wedlock, just like I was, told in a book. But she was fine with it too. I think their favorite of my books is probably Bedtime with Buster, because it was about my wonderful dog, and it's certainly the funniest of my four books.
There's so many of us who are dog lovers now. I can hear yours, and you might hear mine in a few minutes, because we love our dogs like they're our children now.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm an empty nester. I assume you're probably an empty nester too. And it changes when you don't have any children in the house. I think it changes your relationship with your dogs. You know, you've got more time for them. They're your only dependents in the house, and it's different.
Yes. My husband has a father daughter day for our two dogs every Sunday and takes them to the dog park. Even though we have plenty of property to run the dogs on, he takes them on outings.
Yeah. They want to see other dogs. Sure. Good for him.
Brooks, our last interview question is always, are writers over 50 are quite a unique set? Do you have advice for writers 50 and above?
Sure, I guess I do. I would say, you know, don't do it with the expectation that you're going to make a handsome living from doing it. Maybe you will. I haven't, and most people don't. No. And don't be disappointed if you don't. Do it for the love of the process, and for the joy you will get. And I'm sure you've experienced this too. You know, I think of two things. One is when I get an email out of the blue from somebody I don't know, telling me how much one of my books meant to him or her. You know, that is a special treat. And the other thing is, you know, when you've slaved over a book and you've reviewed it 14 times and you've talked to the publisher and decided on a title, and finally it goes into production, and you order whatever number of cases of books. And then when they first show up and you open the box and you pick up one of those books, it's like picking up a newborn child. It really is. And it's very gratifying and fulfilling to, you know, take an idea and worked very hard on it. I mean, you know, I've had people tell me that I had a friend who said that he read Fortunate Son, my memoir, in a day. And I said, well, that's hardly fair. It took me a whole lot of days to write it.
That's right.
it's a work. But for me, it's a labor of love, and I really enjoy it.
It really is. And when you write something and you hear back from those readers, like you said, that don't have any connection to you, it really is a feeling that you are leaving a legacy. And you hear from people who share their stories with you, especially other adoptees or birth parents and adoptive parents. And it's just very gratifying.
Girl I grew up with in Tupelo named Carol Harrington, same class. We were friends. I never knew she was adopted. She never knew I was adopted. It wasn't a secret, but it just, you know, never came up. After Fortunate Son, my memoir, came out, she contacted me, and it turned out that she and I were in Methodist Home Hospital in the nursery at the same time. And she said, I'm her oldest friend.
Oh.
And so her parents went from Tupelo to get her a week after my parents went from Tupelo to get me. And she said her father got the call that there's a baby now for you to come get. And he didn't tell her mother. Instead, her mother's birthday was coming up that weekend. And he said, let's go to New Orleans for your birthday. And she said, okay. And they got to New Orleans and checked into the hotel. And he said, you know, we should stop by Methodist Home Hospital and just see if there's any progress on our request, where we are on the waiting list now. And so they went to the home for unwed mothers on Washington Avenue. And the nurse came out and handed Carol to her mother. And her dad said, happy birthday.
No, oh, that's a great story.
Oh yeah,
I love those stories.
Never off and never would have tried.
Well, my dad said he walked through that nursery full of children, and I lifted my arms and said, "Here I am, Daddy."
No, here I am.
So, thank you so much for the stories, Brooks. It's been great talking to you today, and we're excited to say you're now one of our authors over 50.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thanks for doing this. This is a good service you're doing.
Thank you for joining us today. Please look for Authors Over 50 every Thursday when we will have conversations with accomplished debut novelists over the age of 50. Please subscribe and share with a friend. And check out my own publication journey after 50 at www.juliadaily, that's D-A-I-L-Y, like daily newspaper.com. Until next time, keep reading and writing. And remember, it's never too late to fulfill a dream in life's sweetest third.